Hello, everybody. It is great to be here one more time today. My name is Gary Fowler. I'm the CEO, president, founder of GST Get Shit Done Venture Studios, a premier AI and quantum venture studio located in the heart of Silicon Valley. I'm a 17-time serial entrepreneur with several unicorns under the belt. I was on the original management team of Click Software, which was sold to Salesforce for $1.35 billion, and also Eva.ai, an AI HR tech company that I founded with Dr. David Yang. We believe at GST that intellectual capacity is evenly spread around the world, but opportunities are not. Today, I have an incredible guest today, Steven Rothberg. He's a lawyer, he's an entrepreneur, he's an investor. He's got such a wide range of different companies, including his company, College Recruiter. So with that, I'd like to bring Steven on board. Hi, Steven. How are you today?
I'm good, Gary. And slight note of correction. I like to refer to myself as a fully recovered lawyer, but people who know me well will dispute the fully recovered.
I wanted to ask you a question. It's really interesting. You know, when I look back through your background, you got into entrepreneurial activities, you know, selling candy as a kid, running a fantasy hockey league in college. How did these kind of things really shape the way you are today? How did they shape those experiences shape who you are?
Yeah. I think it's interesting because I've been asked that question the other way around. Like, why do you think you're an entrepreneur? Like, where did that start? You're very much asking kind of the opposite. Like, what has that brought me? I would say that being an entrepreneur, that one of the big differences between people who have been an entrepreneur or even want to be, but are taking like real active steps towards that versus people who have no interest, it's just not for them. I think it's a different level of tolerance for risk. And what I mean by risk isn't being foolish, like running through traffic on a major freeway, you know, or anything like that. But I think that people who are comfortable being, you know, a W-2 employee, a contractor, you know, month after month after month after month, they tend not to want to take risk of any kind. And I think entrepreneurs, maybe it's a bit of dopamine hit, but I think we just have a higher tolerance. Hopefully risk where there's a lot more upside and very little downside. That's what I try to do.
You know, when you practice law and you became an entrepreneur, but how was it practice law? Did you like it?
So I went to law school. I live in Minneapolis, went to law school at the University of Minnesota. I kind of moved here for law school, graduated, and I was what was called a judicial law clerk. I was basically a lawyer to a couple of judges and had another one of those to go to when I decided, as I like to say, to get out of law to enjoy my life. So I very much liked being a law clerk when I was in law school. I worked for a big law firm. I worked for a big corporation in-house, and also very much like being a judicial law clerk after graduation for a couple judges. But I never wanted to be a lawyer for the rest of my life.
Why is that? Why did you do it then? Yeah, what made you decide to do it? And then did you have one moment and switch and say, this sucks and I want to do something else?
Yeah. No, where the law thing came from was I had a mentor when I was 13. He was actually one of the lawyers that worked for my dad. My dad was a real estate developer, and one of his lawyers, a guy named Michael Kay, was the youth leader or the leader of a youth group that I was in. So I really got to know Michael when I was like 13, 14, 15, and thought, you know, A, super bright, fun, you know, liked the kind of work and the stuff that he would talk about in terms of his law practice. And I thought that this would be a really great training for my mind to really learn how to think analytically, to learn both sides, you know, to really understand what the person across the desk wants and needs. And if you can get them that, they'll probably also get you some of what you want and need. And I think a good lawyer is somebody who's always looking for that win-win. And that was definitely very formative for me as I became a law clerk while I was in school. And then also after graduation, you really learn to look for win-wins. And, you know, to try to choose, like, is this the hill you're willing to die on, to destroy your reputation or burn bridges? Or is it better to kind of find a deal that you can live with and then leave that door open to doing, you know, more deals or transactions with those people?
You know, what happens? So if you're looking for qualities in a lawyer, you know, going down through, what would you look at? You talk about the win-win, but what kind of qualities that a lawyer should have in order to make a good, at the same time, you want to win, right? You don't want to lose and give up too much. So how do you, what kind of lawyer, if you're going out and looking for a lawyer in him or her, what would you look at and say, you know, those are the kind of qualities that I want so that I feel good about this thing?
That's a great question. So I will do some of the legal work for college recruiter where it's not really legal, like lawyering, like I'll read contracts and, you know, and do some of that negotiation, especially if there's like members of our team that just aren't comfortable doing that. Anything that's complicated, I'm going to outsource. I'm going to send that to one of the lawyers that we work with. And every single lawyer that I've ever worked with that I felt is would be a really good representative of our organization, provide really good advice, they all think of themselves first as counselors, second as lawyers. And it's kind of intertwined, you know, realistically. But if we've got some kind of a dispute, a problem, something to kind of work through that that might be difficult, not just not a, not entering into a contract, but if there's some kind of thing going on that's adversarial with a customer, a partner, a vendor, whatever, I want to be able to go to that lawyer and not just have them say, the law says X, Y, and Z, and therefore, you know, you're in the right, you're in the wrong, let's litigate. I want them to counsel. And I want them to say, you know, the law is on your side and we could litigate this, but I think a much better approach is to do this. You know, to work through it, let's propose this to the other party. And again, try to reach this solution where both sides can live with it, and at a minimum and potentially a real win-win. Litigation is always bad. You know, you know, if you go to court, you're suing somebody, they're suing you. There are no winners, you know.
No, except, I agree on that side, except the lawyers.
Yeah, the lawyers win, and you know, every once in a while, you know, there's essentially a lottery winner where somebody gets hurt or loses some money, and then they end up getting, you know, way more money than they ever could envisioned, and those will make the New York Times. But virtually always, like you said, Gary, the only winners if you go to court are going to be the lawyers who are going to get their, you know, $400, $500, $600, $700 an hour.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's some of the lawyers I use charge more than that, but I love
it. Well, you must be really difficult to work with then.
No, I have my lawyers in Silicon Valley, right? I have really good lawyers. That's another thing I've learned a lesson going down through it is when you're in a jam, you don't want, like, you know, it's not about the price. It's about, you know, who's done the deals. Because when you're into it, you want somebody that's really smart. So that part of it.
Totally.
I've used my multi-agent large language model where I have them set up as a team. Mm-hmm. And I've taken contracts. I built an anti-cancer vaccine. I mean, all kinds of different things using my large language model for my dog, by the way. So my dog had cancer. But what I found is that now the same kind of questions, you know, and potential responses, I've asked the multi-agent model, so ChatGPT, Claude, Bard, I've asked it those things and it's back with incredible advice for me that wasn't the lawyer's advice. Yeah. You know, it was, you know, like you said, it's cut and dry, this is what the law says, et cetera. But it said, hey, listen, you might want to try this, you might want to try that. And it actually counseled me. I couldn't believe it, actually.
Yeah.
And so what do you think? What's going to happen, you know, with these new tools in another 3 to 5 years when you're using AI that's at an entirely different level, what's going to happen to the legal profession?
Well, it's already starting to happen that not just in law, but in, lots of different professions or people looking for fashion advice or whatever, but essentially the LLMs are counseling us in lots of different ways. You know, again, assuming you're asking for advice, right? If you just say like, you know, what color is this tree? It's not going to counsel you about anything. Mm-hmm. One of the problems in law and in other fields is that the LLMs are showing that they have a difficult time distinguishing between fact and opinion. And if there are enough web pages out there that express an opinion that the earth is flat, you're going to have some of those LLMs come back to you saying that the earth is flat. It's not fact-based because they aren't very good at distinguishing fact from opinion. When you talk about the practice of law, the same thing happens, right? You know, you're getting some of those hallucinations. They're making up cases. They're making up statutes. So to go to an LLM and say something like, you know, I've got a problem with a vendor who's paying slowly. What are some strategies for getting them to pay us on time? I think that's fantastic. I don't think you need to go to a lawyer for that. But if you upload a, you know, 48-page contract and say that you've got some kind of intellectual property dispute, you know, and if I sue them, will I win? I think you're playing with fire. And I think you will for a long time. It reminds me of, you know, when you mentioned your dog's cancer, it reminds me of people who think that doctors can be replaced by LLMs because they fed into LLMs symptoms and they're getting back correct answers. The problem with that is that a good doctor, when they see you, your dog, whatever, it's more than just you stating what your symptoms are. They're also observing firsthand. They're, if you tell them that your skin is sensitive, how sensitive is it? Is it all of your skin? Is it just on your hand? They're going to run some tests and some blood tests, for example, that's very cut and dried. You know, your hemoglobin is 12.3. You can feed that into an LLM, but looking at your throat to see if it's inflamed or talking through you with you, you know, hey, you've got a vendor who's not paying you slowly. Do you have a good relationship with them? Have you tried this? Have you tried that? LLMs are just not very good at that yet. 3 to 5 years from now, I think what you're going to see with law is what we're seeing in law and a lot of other areas as well, is that it's going to be a force multiplier. You're going to have lawyers who are 10 times as productive as they are now. And does that mean that they'll only be 10% of the lawyers that there are now? I don't think so. You know, if you're paying $1,000 or $1,200 an hour to your Silicon Valley lawyer, but you knew that you could pay them $120 an hour because they're going to effectively, because they're going to get their work done 10 times as fast, I think it makes it more likely that you're going to reach out to them for help because your return on that investment is going to be higher. So I think in some areas, LLMs are going to lead to greater employment, not lesser employment. Overall, I'm worried, but I do think that there are going to be some winners that are going to come out of this and not just the owners of the LLMs.
Yeah, you know, I've been involved in AI for 29 years, expert systems, and in Silicon Valley, I've been involved in tech 44 years, actually. And some of the things that I've seen are just mind-blowing. Like I talked about to my dog, on myself, I had stage 3 kidney disease, and I put it into my large language models, not one, because the right this thing, they correct each other. So that's one of the other things you're going to start to see in the next year to year and a half, where I'll be out there, these multi-agent, multimodal models that actually course correct each other. And if you take some of the tools like Claude, they can be a thousand times faster than some of the other tools. And if you put those in as a team, all of a sudden it takes a team approach. And this is exactly what happened to me. I had stage 3 kidney disease and they told me it can't be repaired. It can only be managed. And so I put it in my large language model and I had to look at all the literature out there because it went out, you know, it went out to medical journals. It went everywhere. And they, as a team, came back and said, there is a way, mesenchymal stem cells from an umbilical cord that could help. This is frontier medicine, and these are exactly the people that can help you. And it named the persons in the clinics. And so, you know, I was blown away. One's in Bangkok, Thailand, another one's in Panama, another one's in Costa Rica. So, but the top guy for me was in Thailand. This is, you got Harvard, Yale, MIT trained doctors that go there. I'm like, why would they go there? Well, you can't do it in the US because of there were some religious situations that cut stem cells. You know, you get an umbilical cord, somebody's already had a baby, you get an umbilical cord, you create the big cells. Anyhow, I went over and had it done. After doing this, I had leap of faith, I call it. You know, went out, I've used this so much, you understand the capabilities. And I went over there, and within a week, my stage 3 kidney disease went back to normal. No disease. It went in and got intravenously, went into my body, went to my heart, lungs, kidney, and started changing, and my brain. It went across the blood-brain barrier, and it changed things. So I didn't bench my mental capability at the time, you know, my intuition, my cognitive capabilities. But I can tell you it's different because I remember things that happened years ago, like identically. And so my sciatica went out of my back. I don't have any pains in my back anymore that I'd had for 30 years from judo. I don't have any neck pains. I feel stronger. I ride my bike. I just rode my bike 20 miles earlier today. I'll ride another 20 miles tonight. Things that I normally could. Now you could say, you can think Pygmalion effect, the self-fulfilling prophecy. You could think yourself through it. But I didn't think myself through sciatica and the stage 3 kidney disease. That was fact. And these frontier medicines, using these tools for all of us out there that give you superpowers, you're going to see people, just like we said, Stephen said, you're going to see lawyers that are 10 times more effective, maybe 1,000 times, right? Because they're going to have powers and they're going to harness those powers and they're going to move very, very quickly, right? And one side, they're going to know how to deal with you using things like sentiment analysis, how to exactly deal with you as a client, as a patient, as a doctor, how to deal with you to be able to help you the most. It's just fascinating. Yeah. You know, I've written almost 600 articles about this stuff. So I've written a lot and a few books. It's just incredible. And, you know, so let's go back to College Recruiter. What are some of the most critical milestones? So why did you do College Recruiter? And, you know, what are some of the critical milestones that you've accomplished?
Yeah. So I started the company part-time while I was working as a lawyer, as the law clerk for the judges, the judicial law clerk, way back in the fall of 1991. So it was, that's for all intents and purposes, pre-internet. And, you know, I wanted to get out of law to enjoy my life. I could see what had happened in the legal market in just the few years that I had been in law school and then graduated. It changed from being a profession to being very cutthroat, where instead of having to work, say, 50 hours a week to do well at a larger firm, you were working 70, 80 hours a week. And it's like, I don't want that. And it was destroying some of my friends. And they, all but one of my friends, within just a few years, got out of law where they were in a law firm and they all went in-house working in a corporate environment. And because I didn't want to practice law for the rest of my life, it was like, that's just not the path that I felt I needed to take. It was an option, but it wasn't the path that I needed to take. So I started the business part-time, got some traction pretty quickly. And where College Recruiter came from was that the first few years, the business was basically publishing campus maps, giving the maps for free to the universities, selling advertising around the borders. And that did a good job of hitting the incoming students, staff and faculty, including the freshman students. But what it didn't help with at all were those who had been on campus for a while, and they knew where the restaurants were and the apartment companies and whatnot. And so I wanted to add a publication that would not cannibalize the sales of the map. And so I created a magazine, an employment magazine called College Recruiter. This is around 1994. Within a couple of years, there were four different regionalized versions around the country, distributed by about 250 schools. And I literally walked into a career service office at the University of Minnesota, coincidentally kind of where I had been, where I'd gone to school. And the career service office director said to me in 1996 that there's this thing called the internet And she said that she had never been on it. In hindsight, she had. She didn't realize it because she was using email. But that a lot of her students are using the internet to help them prepare for their on-campus interviews. So, you know, back in the day, Arthur Anderson would come on campus and interview for you for a accounting consulting firm. I've heard
that name for a long time.
Right? Yeah. But it's, you know, those of us of a certain age know that company. Mm-hmm. Those who aren't, think Ernst & Young, Deloitte, KPMG, PwC. It was like one of those. But they would come on campus and interview, you know, dozens of students, mostly from the business school. And the way that students had to prepare for interviews back then was to go to the career service office, to the physical filing cabinet, open it up under the A's, find Arthur Anderson and pull out the annual report and read through that. Some students did, some students didn't. Some of the students that didn't couldn't because those annual reports had a way of being stolen. And so students would go and look at the annual report for their own interview, and then they would keep it to prevent other students from reading the report.
Really?
Yeah, it was pardon my French, pretty shitty. Like, if you have to cheat to get ahead, maybe you shouldn't be getting ahead. In any case, websites at that time were very rudimentary. Only about 50 of the Fortune 500 had websites, and only one of them had a page on their site where you could actually search for job openings. It just wasn't much of a thing when we went live. So the idea behind it was we had this magazine, 250 schools, some of the ads were local, some of them were national. And we wanted to sell the sizzle, not just the steak. So the steak was the ad in the magazine. We felt like that's where the responses would come, where the candidates would see the ads and apply to the jobs. But this new sexy thing called the internet was out there. So we created a website, very rudimentary, very cheaply. And all it was just basically the ads from the magazine scanned and uploaded to the website. So yeah. Mm-hmm. You'd appreciate this, Gary, but you know, if you were searching for a job, an engineering job, you could search, you could click on engineering and see all the engineering jobs. If you were looking for a job in California, you could click on California and see all the jobs in California, but you couldn't see just the engineering jobs in California because there was no real database. Mm-hmm. That was circa 1996. Where the business really came from was 2 weeks later. After the website went live, got a phone call in the office, and it was a financial planner or advisor in Texas. And he said, I just went to Yahoo. I'm looking to hire a bunch of college grads for sales positions. I saw your website. How do I run an ad on it? I'm like, why would anybody want to run a job posting ad on an internet site? The magazine is the steak. The website's just the sizzle. So I explained to the guy how the magazine worked, and then the ads went on the website. And he's like, well, if I just want to run an ad only on the website, what would you charge me? I said, well, the least expensive ad in the magazine is $485 for a few months. And he said, great, you take credit cards. Well, when you've got customers who are looking to give you their money, you usually try to figure out a way of making that happen. Mm-hmm. So said, great, give me your credit card. He told me what the ad was going to be. I had our staff set it up, and a business was born.
Wow, that's amazing. So, you know, when you've gone down through this whole process, what's one mistake you made during the growth of College Recruiter that taught you something very valuable?
Yeah, the biggest mistake by far was not raising outside capital. Now, when I founded the company in 1991, venture capital was nowhere near as big as it is now. You hardly ever heard about things like angel investors, private equity. The way that businesses, startups are funded now is completely different than it was 30 years ago. 30 years ago, virtually all were bootstrapped. Maybe, you know, your parents gave you some money to help you start up. You just didn't have much of that outside investor taking a risk on an itty bitty company with no revenue, probably no real track record, maybe even no products yet. And that's really different than
especially in Pennsylvania or Minnesota.
Yeah. And that's true also. You mean like for those in San Francisco and some markets like that, Boston, it was easier.
You know, it's interesting because as I've gone down through this journey, so in 1991, I started on the 91, 92. So the internet, I remember going down through and I was doing work with Sun Microsystems. I had a stack of all the websites and it was this big.
Yeah.
And I printed them out. And so I had a stack and I'm thinking, this really sucks. Cause I went down to the support person and I said to him, I said, how in the heck can I find something in here? Well, you got to go through it. I'm like, isn't there an easier way? I remember exactly that conversation. You know, here we are. And then I had dinner with Fintan Cerf, who's the guy that, DARPANET. He's actually co-founder of the DARPANET. I had dinner, actually twice I'd met him. And it's interesting because here we are, right? Everything's changed. But now, you know, if you go down through it on the college recruiter side, you know, how has this model evolved for you and how has recruiting talent changed significantly in the past decade?
In the past decade, the vast majority of recruitment or employment ads, job posting ads, call it what you may, in the US specifically, and it's still this case in most of the world, were priced on what we call a traditional duration basis. Mm-hmm. Say $200 for 30 days. Maybe you get 300 people applying, maybe half of them are awesome, maybe you get nobody applying. But you get what you get. A lot of people call it post and pray. You post a job opening and you pray mm-hmm. to get good results. What happened about a decade ago is that Indeed started to popularize pay for performance, pay per click, pay per application. Indeed kind of, they didn't invent it, they popularized it, just like Google didn't invent pay-per-click advertising with search engines, they popularized it. What Indeed did is that they essentially went to their customers and said, rather than paying $200 for 30 days, we're going to charge you per click. Every candidate that sees your posting on Indeed and then clicks the apply button to go over to the employer's page to apply, we're going to charge you, and it varied, 50 cents, a dollar, $1.50, you know, whatever per click. So Indeed was taking on more risk. If the ad did not work, Indeed didn't make money. If the ad worked really well, Indeed made a lot of money. And the beauty of pay for performance, regardless of the industry, is that it better aligns the interests of the vendor and the customer. You both want to make sure the ad works. We did the same sort of thing starting in 2014. We were like virtually every job board, 100% traditional duration based. And I got a couple of calls. One was from Aflac, another was from Uber. Both of them were very large customers of ours at the time. And they basically, within a week, coincidentally, had the same question for us. We're happy with the traditional duration-based package that we have now is $12,500 for the year, but we'd like to get a lot more candidate flow. If we paid you four times as much money, could you get us four times as many candidates? And again, customers trying to give you more money, you should try to figure out a way of making that happen. So we kind of noodled on it, and we realized if we did a pay-per-click or a pay-per-application deal with them, then quite literally the sky's unlimited. You could deliver as many clicks as they're willing to buy, assuming you can find the candidates or get the candidates to the posting. Mm-hmm. So that's what we did. We piloted it. Now people would call that an MVP, a minimally viable product. At the time, we talked about a product that we created with bubblegum, Band-Aids, and baling wire. It was incredibly manual. It was incredibly inefficient. And it was incredibly promising. And then we started to build tech to automate that. Once we had proven out the business model, and also could see how incredibly inefficient it was to do that manually, we built tech. And that's when we should have raised capital. By 2014, you could absolutely raise money. it's actually was probably easier in 2014 than it probably is in 2025.
Well, it's a different model. I mean, the thing is, we deal a lot with family offices. So, you know, I'm in Palm Beach at my house here right now, and spend a lot of time out in California. You know, the one thing about Silicon Valley, it's a port to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. So if I try to raise money in Minnesota, it could be, you know, a third less in valuation. It's a lot harder to get because a lot of the people, you know, have nuts and bolts companies or brick and mortar companies. And, you know, they're conservative, right? It's a different thing. But one thing about the Valley, people forget, right? It's a port to the rest of the world. If I want to raise money from Israel, I raise it there. If I want to raise money from Saudi Arabia, I raise it there. But why? Because they come in. That's where they look for deal flow. It's like, you know, not, I grew up on a farm in Pennsylvania. You know, one thing, we knew which lake to go fishing in and when they stopped the pond, right? Or the lake. Go there. Listen, we're coming up to the top of the show. We'll have to do a part two on this thing because I have a lot more questions I want to go through. But what advice would you give to someone who's thinking about the jump from, you know, they're a lawyer and they've got a stable career into entrepreneurship? What's one part of piece of advice that you'd give them?
Don't burn bridges. Try to do it in a way that minimizes your risk. So get your business started part-time. See that you're getting some traction. Not just that you have that better mousetrap, but that you're able to market it, that people are willing to buy it. You don't have to like replace all your lawyer income with the income from the business, but I think you want to see that you're going to be able to.
And what's the best way for people to reach out to you?
Couple ways. One is feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm at linkedin.com/IN/Steven, S-T-E-V-E-N, Rothberg, R-O-T-H-B-E-R-G, or shoot me an email, steven@collegerecruiter.com.
That's great, Steven. Thanks for taking time in your busy schedule to join us. I'll jump back on after I end the show. To all of you out there, thanks for joining one more time. My name is Gary Fowler. This is GSD Get You Done Venture Studios, premier AI and quantum venture studio located in the heart of Silicon Valley. Stay happy, stay safe, and stay healthy, and I'll be back to you again soon with another exciting edition. Thank you.